Okay, good morning, everyone, again. I see some of you are slowly streaming in. We're going to go ahead and start the program. I'm sure our colleagues will be joining us throughout the morning. Again, my name is Paul Rendek from the RIPE NCC. I'm the Director of External Relations for our company. I'd just like to ask my colleagues from the RIPE NCC that are here if they could please stand up, because I think that some of you, if you would like to meet our staff, here we are. We're here with quite a crew of people. We, as the RIPE NCC, obviously we're here for you, our members, and also the technical community here. We are always so happy to engage with you. It's great to be here. We're at ENOG number 2. That's fantastic. Yesterday there was such a great showing of people, that came also to the social that was hosted by MSKIX. It was a fabulous time. You see, it's very important for us to come together as a technical community. The world is changing and what's happening, and I think that we need to find our place and where we are as a technical community. I think that events such as ENOG and events such as the MSKIX Forum bring everyone together. You get a chance to meet new people. You get to meet your colleagues. There's a chance for you to do business, hopefully to learn something new, and also to engage and feel part of the technical community, and that's great. And I think that what we're seeing happening over the times that we've had these meetings, for instance, the RIPE NCC regional meetings, and of course, you know, what's rolling into what we see now as ENOG, we can see that we've got a good following of people. It's great to see the energy that comes together here. So I hope we can continue to keep this up, because I think it's important for us to show the rest of the world that the community here is very vibrant, and that's very good. So without holding anything further, we have a set of talks today. The first up is Elena Voronina, the director of Moscow Internet Exchange, and she's going to give us a welcome address. Elena.
Я прошу прощения, вот Макинтош не вполне знаком мне. Вот сейчас мне коллеги здесь помогут. Значит, добрый день, уважаемые коллеги. В этом году в рамках... Спасибо. Спасибо. В рамках второй встречи ЮНОК мы объединили два события. Это пиринговые форумы MSKIX и RIPE Regional Meeting. Объединили, потому что оба события имеют своим фокусом технологии, которые лежат в области интернета. И хочется верить, что ЕНОК станет площадкой, популярной площадкой для обмена мнениями, для дискуссий, для установления дружеских и бизнес-связей, что послужит развитию интернета в России и не только в России. Ну, во-первых, я хочу поблагодарить участников вчерашнего пирингового форума за активное участие в его работе и предложить вашему вниманию несколько цифр о MSKIX. Что такое MSKIX на сегодня? На сегодня это сеть, это 12 узлов подключения в Москве, объединенных высокоскоростными каналами. Это более 700 гигабит трафика, IP4 трафика. Вот в эти выходные мы преодолели барьер 800 гигабит. Это 346 участников. 328 из них используют роут-сервер. Это означает, что они имеют открытую пиринговую политику. И при подключении к АЭКСу любой провайдер, который еще не имеет достаточно пиринговых связей, сразу же получает достаточный объем трафика. Через нашу инфраструктуру, вот уже такая последняя новость, ходит около 8 гигабит IPv6 трафика, что вот по сравнению с прошлыми годами такая значительная цифра. И 112 участников используют IPv6 адресацию. На этом слайде приведена статистика по роут-серверу. Ввела на IPv4, содержит около 20 тысяч префиксов. IPv6 значительно меньше, где-то 253 префикса, но рост значительно быстрее, чем в области IPv4. В этом году мы открыли новую площадку подключения. Это в дата-центре Техногород, проезд Марьиной Рощи, дом 40. Вы можете иметь эту площадку в виду, если планируете подключение. Площадка хорошо развивается. Подключение осуществляется на скоростях до 10 гигабит в секунду. Введено два новых сервера. Это кэширующий DNS, резервер поставлен на базе MSKX, и сервис NTP. Сервис для участников MSKX бесплатен. То есть вы можете, имея подключение к MSKX, использовать оба этих сервиса. И немножко я хочу рассказать о региональном проекте. Новости региональных АЭКСов. Значит, во-первых, в этом году мы на всех площадках реализовали возможность использования IPv6 для провайдеров. Но нужно сказать, что вот в отличие, так скажем, Москва и Санкт-Петербург являются исключением, на остальных площадках у нас IPv6 трафик очень низкий. Но мы надеемся на перспективе на его развитие. Открыта новая площадка в Санкт-Петербурге, это дата-центр «Радуга», улица Кантемировская. В Новосибирске тоже открыта новая площадка на Серебренниковской. И в ближайшее время мы планируем открыть площадку в Екатеринбурге. Это будет уже там третья точка подключения. Новость последней недели: в Ставрополе организован новый интернет-экченч. Вот он свеженький, только-только смонтирован. Сразу же мы поставили там оборудование, которое дает возможность подключения на порты до 10 гигабит в секунду. Ну и вот первый участник у нас подключился. Правда, перед ему пока не с кем, но здесь, я думаю, тоже перспектива. Так выглядит наша география. Это региональные АЭКСы. И на сегодня мы имеем подключение около 560 провайдеров, вот включая все точки подключения через всю Россию. Так вот, на самом деле, да, с учетом того, что в Ставрополе тоже сделан узел. Ну, коллеги, это все, что я хотела вам рассказать. Если есть вопросы, пожалуйста, я готова ответить. Спасибо за внимание.
Thank you very much, Elena. I'm wondering how I can wake all of you people up here. I hope it's not too early for you. Thank you very much, Elena, for that. Okay, next, we have somebody here from the ministry. I would like to invite Mr. Igor Milashevsky. He is the Director General in the Ministry of Telecom and Mass Communications of the Russian Federation, and he's here to give us a welcome note as well for this ENOG meeting. Thank you.
Добрый день. Спасибо большое за приглашение. Участие регулятора в ваших форумах регулярных, может быть, на сегодня не является таким активным, каким хотелось бы нам. Но вот, по крайней мере, в своем приветственном слове я хочу подтвердить, что мы искренне благодарны организаторам RIP NCC и MSKIX за проведение этого форума в Москве, что, конечно, способствует участию большого количества профессиональных участников рынка. Желаю успеха в вашем форуме и надеюсь, что в результате обмена мнениями вы будете развивать интернет в правильном направлении. Но это у меня такая формальная часть. Но, может быть, я еще несколько слов скажу от себя. Потому что довольно сложно выступать на таком форуме представителю органа исполнительной власти. Вот, и вот чтобы как бы не смешивать официальную позицию, которая, может быть, еще и не утверждена, я поделюсь своими личными мыслями о том, что есть ощущение о очень существенных изменениях, которые происходят в интернете. То есть, во-первых, его масштаб достиг совершенно непрогнозируемых размеров, о чем мы только что услышали в докладе, например, о трафике через интернет-эксченж даже на территории России. И, во-вторых, характер сети меняется. Может быть, это вообще уже не сеть, это скорее информационная система, и какой она имеет принцип построения, и какую архитектуру, и кто это планирует, и, соответственно, может спрогнозировать ее надежность, устойчивость, непрерывность сервиса. Эти вопросы волнуют, ну или скорее начинают волновать регуляторов и регуляторов России. Поэтому мы начали участвовать в каких-то форумах, которые посвящены управлению интернетом. Ну, поскольку говорю от себя, то скорее хочется отметить какие-то... Ну, то есть, мультистейкхолдинг, да, можно и спеть дифирамбы этой модели, но в каждой модели есть недостатки. И вот сегодня, стоя перед вами, вот, играя роль, может быть, такого приглашенного клоуна, я, тем не менее, искренне выражаю уважение, потому что вы представляете наиболее профессиональную часть участников в этой мультистейкхолдинг модели. И я надеюсь, что именно в диалоге с вами и в вашей работе можно находить ответы на наиболее существенные вопросы, которые сегодня возникают. То есть одновременное внедрение существенных механизмов и архитектурных решений, IPv6, DNSSEC, NewGTLD, BGPSEC, RPKI, то есть что, как все это будет влиять на функционирование сети, видимо, понятнее всего, ну или больше всего озабочены вы. Поэтому давайте взаимодействовать. Мы постараемся оказать поддержку, которая нужна в вашей работе. Потому что именно от нее зависит сохранение единства интернета интерконнект между различными региональными и просто ISP. Ну, наверное, я на этом закончу свое рассуждение. Еще раз от души желаю успешной работы и подтверждаю нашу заинтересованность в ней и готовность к взаимодействию. Хорошего дня.
Можно вопрос?
Go ahead, please ask your question. Yeah, okay. Are there any questions? Please come to the microphone if you'd like to ask the question.
Здравствуйте, меня зовут Федор Дикарев, компания Rambler. Вопрос у меня, может, не совсем так по теме, но очень интересно узнать от представителя государства, насколько государство заинтересовано в подготовке специалистов в данной области. Ну, то есть, я вот не знаю ни одного человека, который бы вот прям учился на, ну, даже не, ну, как бы на там, системного администратора. Большинство людей, которые вот в этом бизнесе работают, они в какой-то степени они самоучки. И, ну, явно ощущается недостаток толковых людей.
Ну, ответ короткий. Конечно, государство заинтересовано. И в государстве есть настроенные механизмы по стимулированию образования и появлению новых специальностей образовательных, ну, в основных, в новых возникающих областях. Вот, в частности, в области IT. Но вот конкретно интернет, специализация действительно, ну, здесь есть некоторый, ну, провал. То есть у нас, ну, вот буквально сейчас уточняется там перечень квалификаций, и в них пока не появилось квалификаций для всех уровней образования со словом интернет. Но на самом деле я не могу сказать, что это только наша вина, потому что регуляторы и, по крайней мере, Министерство связи массовых коммуникаций такую работу проводит вместе с профессиональным сообществом. И если в области IT, разработки программного обеспечения, ну, есть активно взаимодействующие с нами ассоциации, то в области интернета такого взаимодействия пока нет. Поэтому я здесь, поэтому я, ну, призываю к такому взаимодействию. И в частности мы обсуждали перспективу организации ассоциации операторов, ну, вот в России, условно говоря, или на большей территории. Это было бы очень хорошо. И было бы очень хорошо, если бы вот этим вопросом образования там уделялось внимание. Мы будем очень внимательны и, ну, и даже проактивными в этой области. Нам нужен диалог.
Спасибо.
Марис Алексеев, Красноярск, ЗАО «Интертакс». Я дополнение небольшое по этому вопросу. Вы представляете уровень заработной платы молодого человека, который после окончания высшего учебного заведения решил остаться в, ну, в университете, допустим, на должности там, младшего научного сотрудника или какая ему там будет доступна?
Представляю.
Можете озвучить? Я скажу, 7 тысяч рублей. Какие могут быть комментарии?
А можно я вас дополню? Когда я...
Прошу прощения, Александр Исавнин, Медиа Альянс. Когда я закончил высшее учебное заведение, остался на должности младшего научного сотрудника, моя зарплата составляла что-то около 50 долларов. 7 тысяч рублей – это сейчас 250, наверное, да, там с хвостиком, да. Ну, видите, прогресс, да. Ну, это был там, допустим, 2000 год. Но у меня вопрос, собственно, к представителю регулятора. Мне лично меня интересует, когда регулятор сможет сформулировать свою точку зрения на такую крайне инновационную и очень модернизационную технологию, как IPv6. Вот сейчас, как бы, это одна из ключевых технологий, по которым строится современный интернет. И, к сожалению, регулятор не имеет никакой позиции на эту тему.
Эта технология вырабатывается вне поля ответственности какого-либо государственного регулятора, мне так кажется. Вот. Вопрос очень важный. Ну, давайте обсудим, что вы конкретно имеете в виду, какое здесь влияние регулятора, какое здесь влияние регулятора нужно именно для внедрения IPv6?
Ну, давайте я уточню свой вопрос. Регулятор знает про технологию IPv4 при лицензировании, задает вопрос, откуда у вас адреса, и там при сдаче узлов в эксплуатацию они, по крайней мере, пингуют www.ru, да, представителей регулятора. Вот, соответственно, вот когда они будут пинговать www.ru по IPv6?
Хороший вопрос. Давайте я его запомню. Спасибо за вопрос. А на предыдущее выступление у меня тоже есть комментарий. Я в зале стою, поэтому вот играю такую роль, то я тоже подошел и спрошу вас, а знаете ли вы мою зарплату? Вот, ну, вопрос зарплаты очень важен, его, конечно, нужно исправлять. Я вижу тенденции к улучшению ситуации, но это вне поля моей ответственности и даже вне поля ответственности министерств. Здесь другие принципы регулирования. Не услышал. Ну, в таком случае никакой орган исполнительной власти никому не нужен. Я бы так сказал.
Можно?
Но я так не говорю.
Вячеслав Калинин, город Новосибирск, компания РТКОМ Сибирь. У меня есть два вопроса. Вопрос номер один – это какие задачи ставит перед собой Министерство массовых коммуникаций в области регулирования? То есть с технической точки зрения, в принципе, все понятно. Есть лицензионная политика, есть, кроме того, сам рынок является очень мощным регулятором, потому что к провайдеру, у которого плохое качество связи, люди не пойдут. Вот, как это видит, какие задачи видит перед собой Министерство массовых коммуникаций? Это вопрос номер один. И вопрос номер два. Хотелось бы узнать об уровне компетенции. То есть вот сейчас как раз коллега задавал вопрос по IPv6, и мой вопрос, он маленько с этим перекликается. Насколько в регулирующих органах работают компетентные сотрудники, которые следуют всем, то есть изучают, исследуют, пробуют на практике все новейшие технические достижения в этой области. Спасибо.
Ну, спасибо за вопрос. Он такой практически экзаменационный. Ну вот, если с конца начать, то конечно, в госорганах и в поле непосредственного влияния, то есть в подведомственных организациях, ну, есть недостаток людей с соответствующим образованием и опытом, но, тем не менее, они есть. Вот, поэтому заботы о выработке политики и задач имеют исполнителей. Вот. Я не могу сказать, что эта политика уже выработана. Но основное направление – это, прежде всего, защита потребителей и как бы национальных участников рынка с точки зрения, ну, глобальной стабильности и устойчивости интернета. То есть мне очень нравились когда-то архитектурные принципы интернета, но вот они сейчас уже, похоже, не являются правдой. А что является правдой? Именно это и нужно сформулировать. И это непростые формулировки. Вот, ну, уж точно не RAF-консенсус и running code – единственное то, во что мы верим. И на сегодня в интернет погружаются настолько важные информационные ресурсы и услуги, что, ну, поверьте, озабоченность есть. Спасибо.
I think we can only take two more questions. I see two people at the microphone, because just to respect the time, if we can, please.
Константин Бекреев, Дарстелеком, город Ульяновск. Вот возвращаясь к первому вопросу, мне бы хотелось просто как бы, что налажено было взаимодействие между вашим министерством и министерством образования. В каком плане? То есть сам я учился на кафедре телекоммуникационных технологий и сетей, вот, и то есть там проблема очень простая. То есть они как бы, скорее всего, не знают просто откуда взять, ну просто целенаправленно взять информацию о том, чему сейчас стоит вот именно современным каким-то методом построения сетей обучать студентов. Так решение, мне кажется, очень простое. То есть просто рекомендовать Министерству образования регулярно, то есть каждый год брать последние курсы обучения для специалистов в области телекоммуникационных сетей, да, именно с сайта RIPE.NCC, то есть там достаточно хорошие и понятные курсы, и всегда последняя информация будет. Такое пожелание.
Спасибо. Это очень конструктивное предложение. Я на такие, собственно, и рассчитывал. Легче уже.
У меня вопрос относительно ассоциации. Вот вы сказали, что хотели бы видеть ассоциацию интернет-провайдеров. Ее не хватает. Вот на ваш взгляд, какие функции она должна выполнять? Для чего ассоциация?
Ну, прежде всего, те же функции обеспечения работающего интернета на региональном сегменте, на котором эта ассоциация будет организована, ну, как бы бесшовного интерконнекта. Ну, по крайней мере, если не решение, то поднятие основных существенных вопросов, которые могут повлиять на доступность сервисов.
Для этого у нее должны быть соответствующие права.
Права? Ну, знаете, все зарегламентировано в области, ну, скажем, госорганов, но даже там, а уж тем более на рынке, по-моему, самым правильным принципом является: власть не дает, ее берут. Делайте ассоциацию.
Я хочу сказать, что вопрос на самом деле очень интересный. Вот он меня лично очень интересует, как директор МСКАИК. Смогу ли я вот с вами продолжить диалог на этот счет?
Можете ли вы что?
Работает он еще? Я хочу сказать, что вот вопрос ассоциации интернет-провайдеров, он очень интересен. Я думаю, не только мне. И хотелось бы продолжить диалог на эту тему. Как это можно сделать?
Ну, я вам оставил визитку и жду звонка вот буквально с сегодняшнего дня.
Спасибо.
У меня такое.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Igor. Thank you. Sorry, I just have to cut that short so we can finish the session. I'm sorry. Thank you very much for that. Thank you very much.
I wanted to say a few comments over the discussion that you've just had here. The issues you're bringing forward, this is not something that's just specific here to Russia. I spend most of my time these days dealing in the internet governance arena, talking to a lot of ministries, a lot of regulators. It probably consumes about 90% of my job these days. And what I can say is that you're asking, what can the ministry do? What are they doing about IPv6? I can tell you now that the world that we're living in and the internet space, it's changing phenomenally, which is one of the reasons why we think it's so important that the technical community comes together. You have to have your voice. You have to be a body that can actually collaborate with more than just other technical people. You need to be able to play with government. You need to be able to play with business. You need to be able to play with civil society. And understand that there are people or sectors out there that don't understand your viewpoint, that don't understand the way that you operate, and they have to make decisions of their own. Because, of course, as we all see, the internet is a much bigger space than just a bunch of techies getting together and running the net. Yes, we have a very specific task to do, running the net, but we also have a task to make sure we let others understand what is important for running the net so that they can make the right decisions they have to make. One of the things that came out of our colleague from the ministry, one word that he said was just great, which kind of lifted my head, and that was collaboration with the technical community. I think this is something that is new here. It's, again, not something specific to Russia. I'm seeing this in every country that I'm going to. The technical community is wondering what position it has and how it is supposed to be relating to its various government bodies. Again, you're here. You have ENOG. You bring yourselves together. You have opinions. You have a voice. I think you can voice that through this. What I can say that the Ripe NCC is doing is that we do work with governments. We have something called an IPv6 roadshow that we launched in the Middle East. We work with all the regulatory bodies, making sure that we get governments and enterprise, as well as our own technical community, up to speed with training on IPv6. Now, we want to launch the same thing here in ENOG, and we have actually talked to some of the ministries. They're very interested in the word collaboration and will help us bring the people we need to bring to train. Again, those resources come from this community. We are the experts. Our colleague from the ministry said that. We are the experts that run the internet. We need to make sure that we provide the information others need to make the decisions they have, and they're part of governing the internet. And I think that's a very important conclusion for this. But thank you very much again for coming. Thank you. So if I can just move on with the next speaker, if I can ask Paul Vixie from ISC to come up. Paul is going to give us a presentation on the history of neutral commercial peering exchange, lessons from the Palo Alto Internet Exchange. So, Paul, thank you.
Hello, good morning. I am Paul Vixie, and I see that we all stayed up pretty late last night, maybe drank a little more than we thought, and a number of people are not here yet. Nevertheless, I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad to have the chance to tell this story again. Wait a moment.
Sorry about that.
Good. So, I am the teller of the story because the Palo Alto Internet Exchange grew out of my work, and I returned to it several times across its years of existence. Many other people were involved, but I am the one who knows the whole story, so they send me when it's time to talk. I think all internet stories must begin with Berkeley Unix. 4.2 Berkeley Unix was the first really widely used version of internet software. It was the first time that you could use Telnet and FTP and things like that. And this was in the early 1980s. This is where SendMail came into existence, which is what caused SMTP to first be widely used. Now, this was an academic internet that it had itself grown out of the defense industry. So sometimes it is said that the American military invented the internet. That's not true. A bunch of computer folks all over the world, a lot of them funded with American military money, wanted to exchange information with each other, and they therefore built the internet in order to do that. In those days, computers were large and few and expensive. So you could imagine a computer that was as large as most of the cars that are parked in the hotel parking lot, and that the university might have only one of those. Or if they were an extremely wealthy university, they might have three or four. And those were hosts. So the things that we virtualize today with Xen and VMware and sometimes have five or six different virtual hosts running on our laptop used to be real computers, and they were really expensive. It became important to be able to get files between them and to log into one while you're physically attached to another and so on. And that really was, that's all we did. The internet was a boring place. There were no graphics. It was all text. It was mostly English language. Anyway, 4.3 came out a few years after 4.2 BSD. This is, again, Berkeley Unix. And this is when DNS was added. That turned out to be a hugely important change because up until that time, all of the hosts on the internet could be listed in one file, and there was one such file, hosts.txt, and we all downloaded that file every week and converted that into our local hosts format. Whatever operating system specific format we needed, we could generate from that one shared file. That was a growth problem for the internet. When that file got to be extremely large, like let's say 1 megabyte in size, it was a real burden because most of our links were 56 kilobit links. That was what a lot of the backbone connections were. So using the domain name system, it became possible for someone to add a host which you would be able to reach by name, even though that host was not listed in a file on your hard drive. And again, this may seem trivial to you now, since we all use the DNS every day. But the first time this really came into wide-scale use was 1986 when 4.3 BSD came out and 1987 when .com/.net and .org were added. Host names used to end in .arpa or similar. So the other thing that was going on at those times was UUCP. So a lot of early domain name use was not on the internet. It was over modems. UUCP was the Unix to Unix copy program. And it was a way of remotely executing a program on some other host, but it was batch-oriented. It was not interactive. And if you had thousands or tens of thousands of computers all running this, then it became possible to send mail to someone far away by routing it sort of hop by hop through a network of cooperating modems. It seems amazing to me that something this hacky ever worked. It was terrible, and it was very exciting. You could send mail without licking stamps and using your postbox. Anyway, a company called UUNET was started. It came out of Usenix, which is a sort of a nonprofit computer society, similar to, I guess, ISOC or ACM. They funded the existence of this nonprofit version of UUNET in order to make this modem system more reliable and to sort of give somebody, create a business that you could pay a fee to in order to get a connection to this network. And again, it was all done with modems. And so 9 kilobits per second was considered very fast at that time. Most of us were going slower. But that's the prehistory. That's the context that I was coming from at the time that I sort of went to work at Digital Equipment Corporation, which is where PAX was first started. So as to why I was there, I will explain that there's a book, and you can buy this on Amazon.com. It's called Fumbling the Future. And it talks a lot about the ways in which the Xerox company, which maybe you know as a company that makes copy machines, had first invented a lot of the technologies that would later become the Macintosh, the IBM PC, the Internet, and so on. But they did not know how to commercialize it. So although they invented it about 10 years before anyone had heard of such things, they completely squandered their opportunity. But they were not alone. Digital Equipment also squandered some incredible opportunities. BSD Unix, this Berkeley Unix, was at that time only available if you had a Unix license from AT&T, and you had to have a piece of equipment from Digital, DEC, in order to run it. It would either be an older PDP-11 or a new VAX. It's hard to explain how important the VAX was, but it was like the IBM PC or the 386 PC of its day. So those of us who liked Berkeley Unix and liked the Internet knew about DEC, and so I always sort of wanted to work at DEC. The part of DEC I went to work in was the Western Research Lab in Palo Alto, California. And their achievement at that time was that they had created the first reduced instruction set Unix computer, and it ran about 10 million instructions per second. And they had this working in 1985, and if you were in the industry at that time, you know that there were other reduced instruction set computers that were also available. Pyramid, for example, had one. Sun was selling 68,000 based systems at that time. And the most that anyone else could do was about one-third of what this computer could do at DEC. I was very excited to go to work for the people who could build such a thing. As I arrived, DEC canceled this project because they were concerned that this Unix thing would threaten their commercial product, which was VMS, and they were concerned that this reduced instruction set thing would threaten the sales of their VAX. And so It took another 4 or 5 years for the industry to catch up to what DEC was ready to sell as a product in 1985. So I think Xerox is not alone in having fumbled the future. Nevertheless, I was at DEC because it was an interesting place. It was full of smart people, and they were the corporate internet gateway. And the internet, as I've described, was smaller and slower then than it is now, but DEC at that time had more than 100,000 employees, and they had their own internal network that was not internet-based, and they had to have a way of connecting their internal network to the rest of the sort of non-commercial research-oriented internet. And we were the place that happened, and that was, again, very interesting to me. So as I arrived, we had a very slow 9-kilobit connection to NASA, which was the hub for the ARPANET in California at that time. And I added various connections, including a 56-kilobit connection to CSNET, which was intended to be kind of a commercial version of the Internet. It was a project at Purdue and BBN and so forth. I also added a connection to Alternet, which was our first multi-megabit connection. It was a T1 line, seemed very fast to us at the time. Alternet was the first fully commercial internet provider and had grown out of the UUNET business. So I mentioned UUNET on my previous slide. When they saw that there would be sort of a lot of growth on this whole network thing, they decided that modems were not the future. So they added an IP-based product, and I think that product is still in existence. AS701 is one of the largest. I think it's owned now by Verizon Business. So they were clearly right when they switched from modems to hard lines and from dial-up to fixed connections running IP. I also added a 10-megabit connection to BARNET, the Bay Area Regional Research Network, that was an NSF regional. Now, that was an interesting connection because it ran over satellite. I myself did some drinking last night. Let me try again. It ran over microwave dishes. And it was maybe a 7-kilometer range, which was the outside distance that those microwave antennas could reach. And we did climb up on the roof from time to time to repoint them if they would drift and so forth. So it was incredibly unreliable. It would not work as well when it rained, for example. At one point we had to cut a tree down that had grown up in the middle of our path. But again, this was state of the art for 1989. To have a 10-megabit internet connection was gigantic. No one had ever heard of such a thing. Now, because I was in a research lab, a lot of this was done without a budget. And I'm going to come back to sort of how you build things without a budget in a moment. But now let's talk about what was going on outside of digital. Once again, I want to provide the context for PACS as a neutral commercial internet exchange. So it was decided, not just by Al Gore, but various people around the world, and a lot of them inside the Washington, D.C. Beltway, knew that the internet had to be privatized and commercialized. And it was that effort that ultimately brought us here to this room today, because if the internet were still only used by academics, then I think none of us would have jobs. A lot of modem users were using at that time UUCP, or they were having shell accounts. You could log into a Unix computer and read your mail. That was considered really quite exciting. But they could replace that with SLIP, serial line IP. So it still ran over modems, but at least you had you could ping people. You could telnet. It was slow, but it was better. The NSF backbone, National Science Foundation backbone, was replaced by ANS, the Advanced Networking System. I forget what that stands for. But that had an AUP, an Acceptable Use Policy. And the AUP for the NSFNet backbone was that you could not do commercial work other than to deliver commercial products to people who had a federal grant of some kind, a grant from the U.S. government that was required them to use the internet to deliver some service or to receive some service from you. In other words, if you were just in the business, if what you wanted to do was sell, shell accounts, or you wanted to buy and sell something and you wanted to use the internet to deliver email to your customers talking about delivery of services, those were commercial uses that were not permitted. And it was important to make that kind of commercial use available. And that's what it really meant to commercialize the internet. It wasn't just to commercialize the provision of internet service, but to commercialize the end users. There was something called the NAP, Network Attachment Point, or something like that. There was NAP of the Americas now, but at that time, NAP meant May East or May West. MAE was the Metropolitan Area Ethernet. It was not Ethernet for very long. We switched from Ethernet to FDDI because Ethernet could only go 10 megabits per second, but FDDI could go 100 megabits per second, and that was a huge change for us. I think the May in Chicago was actually built on an ATM fabric. But you get the idea of some bureaucrats somewhere in the Washington, D.C. beltway deciding that the only way we could have a network would be to give network operators places they could go to exchange traffic with each other. And they felt that that was the government's responsibility, so they sponsored these NAPs. But again, they had an AUP, and this acceptable use policy meant that you were really not able to do normal commerce. Of course, normal commerce is what drives the Internet as we know it today, but at that time, we just didn't know how to do it because the U.S. government could not be in the business of sort of funding a commercial activity like this. They could only fund sort of public benefit research-oriented activities. So I mentioned Alternet was the first commercial IP network. PSI was the second one. They both went into this IP business in a big way, and of course they connected to each other so that their commercial customers would be able to access other commercial customers without going through any of these NAPs because of the acceptable use policy. It became sort of a big deal to avoid the acceptable use policy. A lot of telcos got into the IP business. This may seem shocking to you now to think that there was ever a time, but originally the telcos thought that TCP/IP would not take off. They were backing things like X25, or they were unwittingly providing the backbone because we were using our modems over their systems. But it took actually about 15 years for the telco industry to decide that IP was actually a business they wanted to be in. And so by the early 1990s, Sprint and other large telcos were starting to use their internal capacity for IP rather than just to use it to deliver services to other people who then used it for IP. So that was another big change. KIX, the commercial internet exchange, was started up mostly by Alternet and PSINet, but it was open to all. To anyone who wanted to do commercial internet work, they could connect to KIX and there would be no AUP. At some point, I became involved in KIX. I was called their chief engineer for a while, which sounds very important until you realize they only had one router, so it was a very small job. But it was a very important moment in history because it was the first time that you could, it was the first interconnect that had no AUP. And so we quickly overloaded that one router. It's hard to believe that a lot of people had T1s going to a single router, and that was where all the commercial traffic in the world went to be exchanged among providers. We had a lot of links. We had, I guess a lot. We had 50, I think, T1s at our height. So let's get back to PAX. I left DAC in 1993 after having been there for 5 years. I decided that they had killed all the products that I cared about, and they were pushing a lot of products that I didn't care about, and I was convinced that they would be out of business soon. And I was right. It took them 5 more years, but I was right. In other words, this business of fumbling the future is bad for morale. A lot of people who see a company do a terrible thing after terrible thing after terrible thing, they will leave. So I left. Now, at the time that I left, Alternet and CSNet and Barnet, and of course DEC Western Research Lab, were all connected to a single 10 megabit LAN. And they had been invited to connect to each other, not just to us. In other words, they were there principally to be a service provider to DeckWorld, but we had no objection to them peering directly. It cost us nothing to have them start to exchange traffic. And it seemed to me that a lot of building the Internet at that time amounted to doing the right thing not so much making a lot of money. So I felt that I was helping the other users in California, because if these three networks could not exchange traffic in California, then it would have to be backhauled all the way to the Washington, D.C. area, which was the only other interconnect they had. So this was discovered after I left. In other words, my boss at the time did not know that I had done all of this, but they had to do an audit because after 5 years I had made quite a few changes, and they were sort of digging through the wreckage of all that I had done, and they found that they had an internet exchange in their computer room. And so they called me up and they said, "This is really cool. We would like to hire you as a consultant to help us to commercialize this." And I thought this was good because it was, you know, fun work and I needed the money. So in 1994, we began commercializing something. It was going to be called the DIX, D-I-X, Digital Internet Exchange. But it turns out that there are some negative connotations, phonetically speaking, for DIX. And they ultimately hired a marketing consultant who thought Palo Alto Internet Exchange would be better. 1995 is when UUNET vastly expanded their presence. They were, in many ways, our anchor tenant. They were the only provider who had their own room. Everyone else was in a cage, but they wanted to move in before we had completed construction on the expansion area, so they got to have their own room. And I thought they did a good job. They were the that was the first pre-wired room I had seen. Most of the time, people bring in equipment one router at a time, and they add connections somewhat haphazard fashion, but UUNET actually brought in the same guys who did the waxed string type pre-wire in telco facilities. And they got everything completely wired and completely populated, and there was not a single hair out of place. It was a work of beauty. In 1996, we opened for business. And within 1 year, we were full, and we had to start knocking down other walls in order to sort of make room for all the... It was mostly Asian carriers. It was mostly people from Japan who could not exchange traffic with each other any closer than California for various reasons. And it was also a way to buy capacity, because if you can get to Palo Alto, then you'll be able to then buy either transit or leased lines from all of the telcos who came in. Now, I want to say this was... I still have... I should have put it in the slides, in fact. I have a copy of some email that was sent to the Nanog mailing list when somebody first started talking about this DEC internet exchange. And this email said, "What the hell do we need that for? We've got Mae West," which is true. Mae West was in San Jose. It was maybe 35 kilometers of highway driving, but they were not neutral. Mae West was owned by a phone company. This becomes important. We were not owned by a phone company. Try to imagine if you went into a internet exchange and you brought your routers and everything else and you wanted to buy capacity. Maybe it's a... And back in the 1990s, you'd be buying capacity as OC3 connections, 155 megabits. And you had to pay the price of a local loop, a local circuit, just for a piece of dry coax or dry fiber that went from you to the other cage in the same room where the supplier of the capacity was. So you weren't paying for a cross-connect, you know, maybe $300 U.S. You were paying for an OC3 circuit, which could be $20,000 every month. So I saw that there was a lot of reasons why Mae West was not going to succeed. But I thought it was interesting that the first reaction of people on the Nanog mailing list is literally, "What the hell do we need another exchange point for? We've got Mae West." And again, this is a story, so I get to throw in all kinds of things. So, yes, they had moved to FIDI. A lot of people were arguing that ATM was going to become the primary fabric of interconnect, and that was true at Mae Chicago. You could get an ATM connection into the cloud of May Chicago, and a lot of people got there from here. And a lot of, there were any number of ATM connections from Europe that went all the way to May Chicago in order to get set up an ATM virtual circuit with some peer, and then they would speak BGP. And other people said that ATM probably would not take off because the ratio of packet size to header size was wrong. But I note that we have as many packets per second now over a 10 gigabit Ethernet connection as we used to have over an OC12 ATM connection. And it was considered impossible then to have that number of packets per second because you just couldn't do the header processing fast enough. Now we can. I think we need bigger frames, personally. 1,500 bytes is maybe as bad as 53 bytes used to be. But anyways, a lot of people thought ATM was the future. Kix had moved to a form of ATM. We had the SMDS, which was basically 802.11 Ethernet that is synthesized using an ATM fabric. Switched megabit data service? I don't know what it was. Anyway, we did move to that, and we had that for maybe 2 or 3 years, but even ultimately it proved to be too slow. The same thing for ATM. It just proved to be too slow. So at that time, NSP interconnect between, let's say, Sprint and UUNet would be an example, would tend to be done with leased lines. Somebody would buy a couple of OC12 connections, and the other side would buy a couple of OC12 connections, and they would just interconnect their routers. And so, you know, what seems obvious to me now is that they should have put their routers into the same building and used, you know, dry fiber, which is, of course, what we do. But it wasn't obvious to anybody at that time that there would be enough internet providers to make those rooms profitable. So there were rooms with multiple sets of routers in them, but they tended to have bad power, bad cooling, no remote hands, bad security. They were basically rooms left over from the telephony era, where people would be putting SONET gear and doing interconnect at the SONET level. But SONET gear tended to not have any fans and not generate any heat. Routers at that time were as hot and noisy as routers of this time. And so these rooms were completely unsuitable. It was just there was no possibility of scale. A lot of universities understood the benefits, and they did what I had done at DEC. They invited a bunch of different carriers in and then let them interconnect either free or at a very low charge. But they could not offer commercial contracts. Right? These were universities. They were not in the communications business. So you could not get a service level agreement, you couldn't get guaranteed response time, you couldn't get anything that made it possible for a commercial internet carrier to then sort of create infrastructure that they could sell to commercial customers, banks, for example. And I mentioned that the telcos ran what I call a non-neutral IX center, where if you and your peer, maybe you share a cage wall, you will both have signed an agreement with the owner of that telco house not to poke a piece of fiber through the cage wall and connect your routers together. Your agreement with the owner of the house would be that you could only interconnect through them and that they would charge you normal circuit prices for what were amounted to just pieces of media. So it was a ridiculous situation, and PACS became very successful almost overnight. Now, I mentioned that the internet was largely built without an explicit budget, at least back in the 1980s. I don't know how you're doing it now, but generally companies that are connected to the internet in the United States today know that they are connected, and it's an explicit line item in a budget. But in 1985 and even in 1995, that was largely not true. So we hid the cost of the internet in the phone bill, and we hid all kinds of things. DEC, for example, really didn't believe in the internet. They thought that OSI was really going to take over. They spent billions, that's B, you know, like million, but with a B of dollars, developing something called DECnet Phase 5, because they really thought OSI was going to be the wave of the future. And so this idea that internet companies would need to connect to each other seemed to our corporate masters at DEC to be total foolishness. They didn't think there would ever be enough routers in the world to make that to fill that room. It was strange. It was if you made a movie out of some of the conversations we had with some of those people, it would be a bad movie because it would be unbelievable. You would have to make it with cartoon characters because people were so crazy. Anyway, so since we wanted the money, we told them that there would be servers, and there never were any servers. But we said that there would be a lot of servers from Sun and Pyramid and, you know, even maybe even some DAC servers, and that this would be where internet content would be generated, and that we would have maybe a few routers over in the corner to carry the traffic away. And on the strength of that, they gave us the money to build the facility because they thought that they could then sell field service to these customers to actually maintain all of those different servers. And they did have a business maintaining non-DEC equipment. I guess they wanted to be a service company rather than a computer company. They ultimately found out that there were no servers, but they didn't care because by that time the room was full and it was a very profitable business for them. There were some early customers who really misunderstood the internet model. For example, a couple of people pointed the default route at some peer on the FTDI network. It's like, well, I don't know why you're not sending me a full routing table. I'm here. I'm at PAX. I want internet connectivity, so I'm just going to point my default route at you. I know you. If I send you all my packets, you will have a full routing table. You will be able to take care of them. But we straightened that out ultimately with some technology. The original FTDI switches that we used had access control lists where you could simply say, no, for this provider, you have to arrange with them to be able to reach them at layer two. Other people thought, oh, good, there's an Ethernet fabric down there, and I have an Ethernet or I have an IP address on it, and I can peer. I think I'm going to use half of my rack for myself, and then I'm going to lease the other half of my rack to someone else. And I will connect my PAX port into my switch so that they can access PAX also. And, of course, that was not the deal. Our deal was you get one port for one router. And so we got Extreme Network. The Extreme Networks was our switch vendor by that time. We'd moved off of FDDI. And they added the ability to turn off MAC learning to statically assign a single MAC per port. And then finally, they settled on being able to automatically learn up to one MAC address per port. And I think that's where the technology is today, but I'm not in the business, so I don't actually know how you guys are doing this. But these were all problems that we had to discover by having customers that would then sort of help us learn what was necessary to be in this business. And I call this midnight economics because it was those were the times. The early internet was stolen. We built it out of stolen stuff. We met people in parking lots after midnight to get equipment, to get line cards or whatever. And things just, it was whatever you had to do to build it. And that, of course, changed over time. And again, now the companies that are connected to the internet actually know it. But I worked at four or five companies from 1985 to 1995 who did not know that they were on the internet. They didn't know what the internet was, but I knew that it was important to their business that they be on the internet, and it was kind of fun. This stuff was also kind of fun. You know, they're doing what? Okay, well, let's see what we can do to fix that. So I mentioned a book called Fumbling the Future. DEC certainly did that, as well as Xerox, maybe possibly better. And so in 1998, 5 years after I left them, they were acquired by Compaq, which was known at that time for making laptops. And Compaq, somehow, I'm not sure how they did this, but they really thought that the internet was stupid and that it was a business they should not be in. So they got rid of the two, in my opinion, most important lines of business that DEC was in. Frankly, it would have been better for Compaq if they had shuttered everything else and kept just these two. But instead, they decided that Alta Vista should become a separate company and that PAX should be sold. And we were in the same building, 529 Bryant. I know a lot of you have been there. It's in the middle of the really cutesy downtown area in Palo Alto. There's no parking. Very difficult to drop off your equipment or to visit the facility, but it's fun, and there's great restaurants right across the street and up, great coffee up and down every street and so on. Anyway, that building had both Alta Vista and PAX, and we were in a race to see which line of business would be sold first, because the deal was whoever left Compaq first got the building, and the other one would get a 99-year lease for the part of the building that they wanted to use. And so we lost. Alta Vista won. They got the building. We got a 99-year lease along with a right of first refusal on buying the building if it was ever to be sold. Of course, it's crazy now to think that we didn't get the building. The first time they offered it to us for sale, it was for $44 million U.S., and we said we could not afford it. And so the company that bought Alta Vista bought that building. The next time it was offered for sale, it was for, I think, almost as much money as PAX was originally sold for. It's impossible to overestimate the importance of owning your own infrastructure when you're in the infrastructure business. So Alta Vista later failed. Their assets were sold to Yahoo. Yahoo had their own search engine for a brief time and then decided they weren't even going to do that. So now I know some ex-Alta Vista people who still work at Yahoo, but the Alta Vista product is dead. AboveNet bought us for $70 million. MFN then bought AboveNet for $2 billion. Equinix, around about that time, was founded by a couple of ex-PAX people, Jay Adelson, and forgetting the other fellow's name. And it was because they had tried to commercialize PAX and to buy the asset, but they lost out. And when they lost to AboveNet, they decided they would start their own business. So eventually, the dot-com bubble popped, and a lot of companies went bankrupt, including MFN. And since we were MFN's only profitable business unit, they took the very interesting decision of selling us to prop up the rest. And so it was that we were sold for $44 million to Switch and Data. And about a year ago, maybe a little more, Switch and Data was acquired by Equinix. And I thought that that was a great end to the story because it ended as it began. The people who wanted to have PAX eventually did finally get PAX. Of course, all IXPs are operated this way now. You cannot find a non-neutral place that you could even put a router. And if you could, no one would put a router there. They'd start their own neutral internet exchange. Nobody wants to pay circuit prices to get dry fiber. And there are some internet exchange points out there that operate at layer three. In other words, you connect to them as a router rather than as a switch fabric. But I think that will end. I think that's just a temporary aberration. It's all of the costs and scale efficiencies are at the lower layers, not at the higher layers. So I'm out of time, other than for questions.
Does anybody have any questions? Please come to the microphone.
Добрый день. Как вы считаете, в настоящее время есть ли больше интернет является ли?
Sorry. I should have done this first. Okay.
Good. В настоящее время является ли интернет самым большим too big to fail?
I do not think that the internet is TBTF, no. The internet is not a thing, and I still go to meetings sometimes with politicians in not only my country but other countries who want to know, okay, who's in charge of the internet? I want to buy it. Who is the president of the internet? I need to make a deal. And, you know, ultimately, you wave your arms and you draw pictures on the whiteboard and you just try and explain it isn't a thing. It's an idea. The internet is whatever people will rebuild it as tomorrow when it fails, right? It's not that it's too big to fail. It fails every hour of every day somewhere. And every day we rebuild it and make it bigger or stronger or different, and we route around problems. And I think that the idea, which is the internet, cannot fail. We are humanity's nervous system. But if the internet were a thing, yes, it would have failed by now. But it is not TBTF. Dima.
Paul, what do you think? Why in the United States the traffic more distributed among different dozens of exchange points to compare with Europe, where we have a really super concentrations as AMSAX, M9X here, Lynx, Eurix. You at some moment, something at some moment changed. And for me, it still is some kind of unexplainable. What was the key point, what's the key reason why in the United States it was redistributed?
As you did last time I was in Moscow, you have asked a difficult question. I don't know as much about Europe's internet market as I do in the U.S., but I think what you'll find is, yes, we have dozens, but we don't have dozens of important ones. We probably have the same number of important internet exchanges per population as Europe. And what we also have, though, is a lot of sort of second-tier internet exchange points that are maybe their regional concentration points rather than international exchange points.
There are such super concentration as, for example, AMSAX.
Yeah, I think it's a super concentration in both places. You know, in any part of Europe, there's an obvious place that you have to backhaul your traffic if you want to be in the internet business. And the same is true in the United States. There will be an obvious place. And it might be that the obvious place is not the closest thing to you that calls itself an internet exchange point. It'll be the closest place that has international carriers that you can buy services from.
And as a result, we simply have a different internet from topology point of view.
Yes. Yes, the topology is a hairball.
And it seems the situation that we develop different internets more and more. What's the idea? And it can give more influence in future.
Yes.
Hello. I have the following question. Since you were at the beginning of commercial internet in the United States, could you tell us at which point U.S. government or regulators mentioned existence of commercial internet? How do they regulate, control, not govern, but just regulate internet activities in U.S.?
So there are approximately two political ideologies in the U.S. You would call them the liberals and the conservatives. And they have had a rare agreement about the internet that it should be independent of government. So for the whole history of the internet, there's been a push to keep the government away. We have deliberately not taxed sales that happen through the internet. We have deliberately not applied common carriage rules to internet traffic. That's changing now. I know that the U.S. government, for example, still holds a number of sort of important strings on ICANN, and some people in the world are uncomfortable about that because they see ICANN as being sort of controlled by the U.S. government. But the U.S. government wouldn't know what to do to exercise such control. They simply lack the intelligence about our industry to be able to do anything. And the way that you can see that is some work that's going on in U.S. Congress right now to protect brand holders and copyright holders by giving, by requiring all ISPs to sort of block certain domain names if those domain names are being used for pirated content. Everyone in this room knows why that won't work. It's obvious to you, but they speak very seriously of these matters in the halls of power of the United States Congress. And it's very difficult to explain to them why it won't work and why they shouldn't even try. But those are the people that are in charge of ICANN, and they will never want anything that would work, and so we don't have to worry about them.
Okay, and maybe another question. How does lawful intercept works for U.S.?
I'm sorry, say it again.
How our lawful intercept works for U.S.? If police wants something from ISP, how it's regulated in U.S.?
That is regulated, and the police can ask for a lawful intercept. They can ask for copies of certain flows, but only from providers who have end users. They can't do this for providers who are on the service provider, the content side, only on the access side. And that was there was not even a new law. They just used the existing law allowing them to tap voice telephone calls. That's been true now for many years, and it seems to not have disrupted anything, to the best of my knowledge. How many more questions are we going to take here?
Paul,
okay.
Related questions.
That's someone else to start.
Hi there. Mike from Google. Do you have any opinions on the different models for internet exchanges? In the U.S., they're mostly commercial. In Europe, they're mainly member-based organizations.
I had a debate with Keith Mitchell, who was at that time running the London Internet Exchange. He has since come to work at ISC, so this is many years ago. But I had a debate with him about this because I was running the Palo Alto Internet Exchange that was commercial. He was running the London Internet Exchange. It was membership-based. And I said some things that I now think are foolish. I told him that this membership thing would probably not be able to scale because the members would not be ambitious enough, because there would be no profit motive for growing the infrastructure. And I was completely wrong. Some members maybe cannot afford to grow the infrastructure, but the ones that care about the scale, are like Google, for example, can certainly pay whatever fee it takes to make sure that there's enough capacity. And so at this point, I don't see that there is any real economic reason to prefer one model over another. If you can make it work with members, then I think you probably will, simply because I think the fees will be a little bit lower. There will be no shareholders or no equity to create with the excess in fees. But in the places where there isn't enough interest by members, you probably will see enough interest by investors. But in that sense, I think you'll see more failed commercial exchanges than because a lot of them are built on speculation.
Okay, thank you.
Last question.
Yes, Paul, I decided to use this case to ask you about the situation which happened around Ripensis here during last month, when we have got a police order, Dutch police order, initiated by FBI to freeze some networks. Have you such experience with Arian? And what do you think? Because I know that you and Steve Crocker put a lot of efforts to stop some actions in DNS field. But when I discuss this potential issue with Steve, Steve still answered me, it's your problem, Dima. What do you think about this? Because it's a common problem for all RIRs, the president.
So this is an RIR question, not so much an internet exchange question, but I'm not being thrown off the stage, so I will answer briefly. I should note that I am a member of the Board of Trustees of ARIN, which is the American version of RIPE, if you will. So Dimitri is referring to a case recently in which RIPE and ARIN both received court orders asking that certain network registration data be frozen. It was not asked to be removed or hidden or anonymized or anything else, just that updates should not be possible for certain records. The underlying case was that these network resources were being used by equipment that had been seized by the FBI, which is the federal police force in the United States. And they wanted to ensure that they could continue to operate that equipment because it had a lot of victims were dependent on it. They wanted to make sure they could continue to operate that and that other elements of the criminal gang that had not been arrested at the time of the seizure could not sort of come back and change the registration data and sort of move these network resources to other parts of the world. For me, and Dimitri's question is, you know, doesn't this set a precedent that all RIRs might be concerned about? For me, there was no important precedent because the way that the policy is written at ARIN for transferring of resources is that if the equipment that uses the IP resources changes ownership, then the IP resources can be reassigned to the new owner of that equipment. That's how it is that you can buy a network and not have to renumber it or not have to requalify for the address space. So this was an unusual case because the change in ownership was due to a police seizure rather than an asset sale. However, we recognize simply that the assets had changed ownership and were now the property of the police. And if they asked us to freeze the records, that was okay. That fit our policy.
I have more about the action itself because for me it's more clear if FBI will send the request to Russian police or Ukrainian police in this case to ask to make some actions and to prove that something happened, not to use us as some kind of mediators with unpredictable consequences. Because it seems, because it's well known to whom it belongs. Who is the actors? Who is under the investigation? And for me, it's an imperative that we used as some kind of masquerade.
So I've had several talks with Rob, the chairman of the RIPE community, about the difficulties of having 75 countries in your region and different languages, different legal systems, different police forces, and so forth. This seems to be one of them. The ARIN region is much simpler in comparison, and we have very good relations with all of the federal police forces in our region. And so the situation that you're describing would probably not be a problem in the ARIN region.
But not for your APNIC especially.
I understand, but since you're asking me an ARIN question, I'm giving you the ARIN answer. I think if I take my Aaron hat off and simply speak as a citizen of the internet, I will tell you that recourse is more important than we have given it credit for. I believe that the assets that we hand out, whether they be domain names, IP addresses, AS numbers, belong in some way to the public. They are created by public will. And it should not be possible to hold these assets for the purpose of annoying people. And I think that, for example, the who is privacy that you can have for domain names. There's no public benefit for that. There's no way you can argue that the public has an interest in who is privacy. That's an action by individuals against the public will. And yet, we allow it for domain names. I hope never to see anything like that in the RAR system, but I think we have better governance in the RAR system. But with regard to whether there should be maybe some police forces in your region that you ignore these orders from, I don't know. Let's talk about that with beer in our hands.
Can you imagine, for example, that, for example, in Russia, we will raise the court order to 9/8, because I know that a lot of ВКонтакте films loaded to 9/8. What will be done in the United States in such case?
I'm sorry, that was only...
9/8, it means IBM.
Yeah, you were allowed one question. That was three. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Paul, for that. Thank you. Okay, this brings us up to the coffee break. We're a little bit over time, so what I'm going to ask is that we have coffee up until 25 minutes after 12. That gives us 15 minutes. It's a little bit short, but it will help us bring the time. I'm inviting you all to have two cups of coffee, not just the one. You know? So please, at 12:25, we'll be back in the room. Thank you.